Thank you very much for this invitation. Before I start, I have to tell you that you have taken a great risk inviting a physicist into a theologian's audience. And I have to confess that physicists are very simple-minded people. We make simple models and then we calculate if it functions that way, and sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't. But life is much more complicated than physics. So what you expect, or what you can expect, is a sort of a bird's view on the topics I'll touch as far as possible in 45 minutes. There will be some surprises, I assume, to you. And we will afterwards see how we deal with the problems that created. So thank you very much for bearing that and being willing to go into this interdisciplinary sort of exercise. So with this preliminary remarks, the question is how theologians can address the changing cultural landscape. And I want to deal with this question in three topics. First is the modern church and the post-modern society. The second is the roots of misery. And the third is from reaction to action. I want to give a few ideas on identity politics, wokeness, and cancel culture. Then go on to the secular gospel of guilt and fear. So let us start with an attempt of a definition. We physicists, we try to define the things we are talking about. And so I'll start with two definitions. I define worldviews as a collection of values, views, or concepts, of explanations of the world, the society, or the role of the individual. Perhaps the meaning of life or views on transcendence. So worldviews are, of course, very wide and cover a wide range. So some give answers to all these questions and some don't. And I want to differentiate that to ideologies. And my definition of ideologies is that these are ideas and worldviews which are not based on evidence and good arguments, but that essentially aim to establish or change power relations or power structures in society. This is a big and important difference. And if one looks at the ideologies which have been governing the last century, then one finds that communism is the most deadly and most deceptive ideology of the 20th century. With approximately 150 million democide victims, democide means not people not killed in war action, but people killed in other circumstances by their governments. And what holds for all ideologies is the summary of the life work of Rudolf Rammel, who has worked on death by government, on violence of governments against their own population. And he summarizes for all ideologies, power kills and absolute power kills absolute. So the more unlimited the power of a government is, the more dangerous it is for its own population. And if you look at the deca mega murderers are people who killed more than 10 million people, and we have multiples of that, then we're looking at Hitler, at Stalin, at Mao. Those are the people in history who have killed by far the most people. Now the question is, looking at the Ukraine war, no one knows what is going to happen. Will Putin join the list of shame? We don't know. We hope not, because that would have awful consequences for all of us. Now, looking at the general picture, Jesus says, you know about the rulers of the nations. They hold power over their people, their high officials, order them around. Don't be like that. Instead, anyone who wants to be important among you must be your servant. So this is another view of reigning. And there is another thing Jesus says in John 8, where he says, the devil is a murderer or was a murderer from the beginning, not holding the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So we have seen the huge scope of murders in these ideologies, but there is a huge amount of deception as well. And I think communism and the ideas that came out of it are very deceptive, and many people don't realize that. And I tried to find a definition on these terms, and I looked at Roger Scruton's book, Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands, which is very, very illustrative. I can recommend that to you if you want to have a somewhat concise description of the thinkers, as he calls them, of the New Left. And he says, the basic idea of left thinking is that goods of this world are unjustly distributed and that the fault for this lies not in human nature, but in the wrongful possession practiced by a dominant class. Now, this is a very wide definition, and it's not a party political definition. It is aiming at the heart of the mechanisms of the basic ideas. And there is something right to it and something which is wrong. And what is right is, of course, that the goods of the world are unjustly distributed. We can see that easily when we look at the world. But the lie is that this does not lie in the human nature. And we as Christians would say the human nature, the heart of man, is a problem. And what has to change is the heart of people. If you just change the circumstances, then the heart remains the same and the abuse remains the same and just comes back in other shapes and forms. So the question of this, what he calls left, is how do you create a new just world? And there are a couple of approaches to that. There is classical Marxism, there's neo-Marxism from the Frankfurt School. I don't know if you know that from the German 68 revolution. There is post-Marxist left, and then what we see today is a quasi-religious woke culture. Woke is again a very broad expression, which is not, they don't have a telephone number or an address. It's just an expression for a certain attitude. Yeah, and the classical Marxism talks about the struggle for the means of production, the violent revolution up to the dictatorship of the proletariat. These are the basic ideas, or the basic idea, and I think everybody has heard of that. And then the Frankfurt School established neo-Marxism or cultural Marxism, and the idea is we have to change the culture to bring about a revolution. So this is not necessarily a bloody revolution as in Marx's case, but this is a revolution that comes about from changing the culture, and changing the culture then brings about a new society. And the post-Marxist left, then they said, okay, we have to look for actually or supposedly suppressed minorities to start a revolution. And these minorities can be migrants, can be women, although they are not a minority, can be queer people or whatever you can think of. And the question is a certain minority suitable to help for a revolution? It's not really, in many circumstances, the question, can we help them, but are they suitable to start or to help for a revolution? That's a very important difference. And then there is this quasi-religious woke culture, and there the pseudo-religious component comes in. It's a purification of consciousness through moral superiority. And many of these expressions, like justice and consciousness and so, they sound very Christian, but they are not. So what happens during this development is that we have a new kind of class struggle. I call that class struggle 2.0. The old class struggle is the liberation of the oppressed working class through revolution, and the creation of a revolutionary consciousness of the working class has to be done through the party, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, or whatever it is. Now there's a problem. The working class has a row house, a Mercedes, and is on vacation on Mallorca. So the working class is not really suitable anymore for revolution. That's a worry. Now we have to look for a new class struggle. And that is looking for many oppressed minorities, as I said, women, low wages earner, unemployed, refugees, whatever you want. And the task of this kind of left politics is to make the oppressed aware of their oppression and use alleged or actual injustice to reshape society. I once met a woman, a student, who was in a seminar, and her girlfriend was also in the seminar, and told her friend, and she told her, "Oh, I'm so happy about this seminar. I didn't know that I was oppressed, but now I know that I'm oppressed and discriminated." Yeah, and one of the hard expressions, one of the core questions is, as I said, justice. And so everything becomes a question of justice. Social justice is well known. And of course, we know when there is social injustice, but when do we have social justice? It's a goal that is never achieved. Yeah? And so you can always press for social justice no matter how much the situation has improved. That is not to say that we should not fight injustice, but it's to say that it's a goal without an end. There is distributive justice, there is gender justice, there is climate justice, there is vaccination justice, there is equal representation. So you can think of a lot of other things. Every aspect of life becomes a matter of justice. And so what is the answer to that? The answer is justice turns into equality of distribution. So if you have equality of distribution, 50-50, 50% male, 50% female, and so on and so on, then you have justice. And what we think of justice as Christians should be equality of rights. So justice is filled with a completely different content than we know from the Christian tradition. And if we talk about justice with other people who have a different definition than we are, then we're constantly talking in different directions. So, and this has been so broadly accepted that ideology becomes common sense, and that's very important. So about wokeness, what is wokeness, or what is woke, is belonging to the moral elite. So knowing what is right and enforcing the right mindset. Because if I know what is right for you, then I should go and impose it on you, because you may not be right. But when I know that I am right, I try to impose it for your good, only for your good, on you. And that is often accomplished with seeding fear. And one example you may have heard of is the claim, we are the last generation. So people come up and do damage to infrastructure and block traffic and things like that. And they say, this is justified because we are the last generation. If you don't listen to us, then everything is too late. And that's a lie. No matter what climate change turns out, if it's 1.5 or 2 degrees or whatever, this is not the last generation of mankind. This is just a wrong message, and that's a message of fear. And how worse it ever will be, there will be changing landscapes, and in some areas you can do farming, and in others you cannot, and whatever happens, but it's not the last generation. Humankind will not die out. This is just a wrong message, and a dangerous message. And by this, you develop this cancel culture, you cancel out, or you try to cancel out anything out of public that you do not like, that doesn't support your ideology. You decolonize history or philosophy. You say you cannot quote all these Greek old men in philosophy. You have to find black women who did philosophy. It's a little bit of a problem, but you cannot replace these Greek philosophers. And they are part of history and they have said important things, and you cannot just get rid of it. And then it comes anti-racism, anti-fascism, removing memorials and these kind of things. It is a trial to change history, but history is just the way it was. It cannot be changed, whether you like it or not. And there comes in a pseudo-tolerance. Freedom only is only given in conformity with the ideology. So there's a narrow spectrum, a narrow tunnel of opinions you are allowed to have, and there is much tolerance within this tunnel. But if you get outside, then it's not accepted. And there is a strange situation which is for us very difficult. It's the denial of truth. There is no absolute truth. There is no God. These things don't exist. That's one truth. The other truth is there is no truth. We say we don't need truth, but we have certain kind of truth which we hold on to. And so there is existence of truth and non-existence of truth, depending on what the truth is, and that is coexisting, which is a very confusing setting. And of course, as a consequence, ideology overrules logic. And one example that is just being discussed is pressing for the human right to abortion. It's not just about abortion, it's a human right to abortion. So there is a human right to kill a human. But what is with the human right of those who is killed? So this is a contradiction in itself. It's just weird. And this is basically the ruin of reasoning. If you accept these kind of things, then there's nothing left for a reasonable argument. So this is accomplished with a gospel of guilt and fear. So there is a problem is created, which is the woke guilt complex. So if you are European, if you are German, if you are Christian, if you are white, if you are heterosexual, if you are male, you are guilty because your fathers or forefathers have been in the war or in colonialism or whatever there is. So there is no chance, you are guilty. And they also offer a solution, that is the woke atonement. That is showing the correct attitude, use an appropriate language as a gesture of submission. That's very strong in German language. In English language, it's not so, it's much easier to get around this, because if the teacher says, then it may be a male or female teacher, but we have to say if the wenn der Lehrer oder die Lehrerin sagt, then you have to use certain constructions to show that you submit to this correct attitude. And the surrender to claim to justice is that it's morally necessary. There are no other solutions. It's unavoidable. In Germany, our chancellor has coined the word alternativlos. There is no alternative to this policy. There's just one way to go. So it's narrowing down to just one approach, which is morally correct. The problem is there is never enough. The spiral keeps on spinning and spinning. This is an indulgence trade without indulgence. It goes on and on. No end is in sight. So this is a gospel of guilt, of oppression, of fear, and of activism, but no new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. There are roots of misery. I think there are several reasons. One is a deception from Schleiermacher to Bultmann and beyond. I want to talk a little bit about that, and then the deception of the irrelevance of truth. Many people say as a general argument, okay, Bible is fine, it's a nice book of fairy tales, but we all know there can be no miracles, so this is basically just fairy tales and that's it. And there have been a lot of criticism from the philosophical side and also from the theological side against miracles. And David Hume is one of the well-known proponents. And he said, a miracle may be accurately defined as a transgression of a law of nature by a particular volition of the deity or by the interposition of some invisible agent. So what is good about Hume, he gives a definition, that's fine. And then he says, he concludes, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. So basically what he said is, you can come with any sort of observation and tell me, but I won't believe it because it's impossible. So a miracle is impossible as it would violate laws of nature. And the very big mistake most theologians made was to buy this in. Then Feuerbach came, Das Wesen des Christentums, the essence of Christianity. Feuerbach said, the miracle is senseless for rationality, unthinkable as a wooden iron, as a circle without periphery. Before considering the possibility of the occurrence of a miracle, one should demonstrate the possibility whether a miracle, which is unthinkable, is thinkable. So he makes a very short treatment. There is the a priori assumption of the impossibility of miracles. Then this has not been without influence, of course, on theology, and there is the older theological criticism on miracles from Schleiermacher, Über die Religion, 1799. Texts from Schleiermacher are difficult to read for physicists. He says, wonders are only religious names for occurrences. Every most natural and ordinary one is a miracle as soon as it is suited for a religious interpretation. The more religious you would be, the more miracles you would see everywhere. So his way out is a redefinition of the term miracle. And then Bultmann came, Neues Testament und Mythologie. And Bultmann, in his criticism, says, science and technology are developed so far that no human can seriously stick to the New Testament's worldviews. That's just an assumption. And the decision for a consequently biological worldview, which is what we would term a naturalistic worldview, is first given by the worldview formed through natural science, and then, and this is important, by the self-conception of man, who sees himself as a closed unit, which is not open to the intervention of supernatural powers. This is very interesting because he is not only referring to natural science, but to the self-conception of man. But there are maybe, I don't know how many hundreds self-conceptions of man, and he picks one particular self-conception, of course one which is popular at that time, who says mankind is not open to the intervention of supernatural powers. We are of course open to the intervention of other people because we can talk to each other, we can influence each other, but not to supernatural powers. So the governing worldview is closure to supernatural powers. And as a consequence, he reinterprets the New Testament and he introduced the understanding of myths. So we have to understand the myths behind the stories that we heard to understand what the New Testament is really saying. Now this is called demythologization, Entmythologisierung. And basically, the essence is reports of miracles in the New Testament are myths. They express underlying truths, but they are no historic events. And then the second point is humans are not open to such supernatural power. God can therefore not act on humans. And the third point is God acted in the life of Jesus. Now we have a problem. I would say the program of demythologization is self-contradictory and it depends on pre-philosophical assumptions of the self-conception of man who sees himself as a closed unit which is not open for the intervention of supernatural powers. Now, if you buy that in, if you believe that, There is no reason, not only for miracles, but there is no reason for prayer. There is no room for revelation or anything like that, because even a thought in your mind, as a naturalist, has to do with switching some neurons. But God cannot switch neurons because he cannot intervene from his divine scenery into the natural world. So if you take that consequently, then there is no interaction. We can't know anything about God. There is no connection. It's just completely cut off. The only thing that you can do, or what is left, is natural theology. That's it. I think many theologians have not been clear about the consequences of accepting this, I would say, ideology. But nevertheless, it had a huge impact on Western Christianity, as perhaps you all know. And there have been quite a number of interesting works on the question of miracles, and there have been conferences, and I've also published a paper on that. You can download that. That's open access. Or I heard there are no Germans around you. Otherwise, you could read my book, God and the Explanation of the World, where I make more explanations to that. And a very short, because this normally is a lecture on its own, events are not determined by natural laws on their own. It's always the concept, the context that is decisive. So just a natural law does not say what happens. You can only calculate what happens if you know the boundary conditions and if you know the surroundings. And the processes that we have are embedded in a dense net of causes and effects. That's what I want to show here. So there is an earthquake, and this earthquake damages a city, and then as a consequence of the earthquake and other things, fires arise, and there's great destruction, and so on and so on and so on. So we can make this chain of cause and effects. And usually in normal life, there are many effects and not only one. And that makes this dense net on causes and effects. And now, if you think about how divine action works, then it does not have to break natural laws, but it may just introduce new causes leading to effects that otherwise would not have appeared. And so if God intervenes in the world, something happens that would not happen otherwise. So this is the net without the intervention of God. And if God intervenes, then something else happens. Now, importantly, the distinction between divine intervention and change, chance, often is not possible due to the effects of quantum mechanics and chaos we have. So we have these kind of effects that are only calculatable within a certain probability, and that make the picture difficult because sometimes we cannot say who or what caused this effect. But what we can say is that natural science cannot forbid miracles because natural science cannot prove that the system we are talking about is causally closed. It has to say it is, and then of course God cannot intervene, but this is a pre-philosophical a philosophical assumption that is introduced into the picture. So I'd say there is no good reason or no forcing reason to reject the occurrence of miracles, and so we shouldn't do it. So the second point is a deception of the irrelevance and truth and reason. And I think a marvelous description of this is given by Karl Popper. Karl Popper said the abolishment of reason is destroying the foundations of any communication, and he called that the revolt against reason. And he said that the abandonment of the rationalist attitude of the respect for reason and argument and the other fellow's point of view, the stress upon the deeper layers of human nature, with these deeper layers he means the emotional sort of situation. The stress upon these deeper layers of human nature, all this must lead to the view that thought is merely a somewhat superficial manifestation of what lies within these irrational depths. Now, he concludes that this view must nearly always produce an attitude which considers the person of the thinker instead of his thoughts. And that's what we see exactly today. If someone is on the stage and he or she gives an opinion that's not within the mainstream, then people are not discussing the ideas, but they discuss the person of the thinker. Oh, he may have once obtained applause from the wrong political side, or he is in contact with such and such, who is in contact with such and such, who is in contact with such and such, and he's a very bad guy, so you don't have to listen to his arguments. He's a bad guy, he is not on our moral scale, and so the arguments don't count. And he then further concludes that this setting must produce the belief that we think with our blood, or with our heritage, or with our class, and once we have done this, political egalitarianism becomes practically impossible, and also democracy becomes impossible. Abandoning rational arguments opens the path, as Popper said, for fascism, nationalism, and communism, and these ideologies basically drink from the same source. One step further is Robert Spemann, a Catholic philosopher I value very much. He died in 2018. And he talks about the revolt against truth. He doesn't use this expression. That's an expression that I use here. And he says that whoever denies reason's capacity for truth, whoever denies the validity of the principle of contradiction, can no longer say anything at all. Indeed, even the thesis that there is no truth presupposes truth, at least for this thesis. Otherwise, we will end up in the absurd. So if you would make the statement, there is truth, then the statement has at least to be truth. So there has to be at least some truth, otherwise you couldn't make the statement. So you are ending up in a contradiction in itself. And then Nietzsche starts with the objection, yeah, who says that we don't live in the absurd? We may be getting ourselves into contradictions, but that's the way it is. Reason's despair of itself cannot be articulated again in a logically consistent form. We must learn to live without truth. Now, that comes with a price. Life without truth is absurd. If you want to accept that, well, but I think you better don't. So, what comes out of all that? I only could touch several points I find important. I think we have, especially as a church, come from reacting to things, reacting to worldviews, reacting to developments, and admitting to these kind of ideological presuppositions, to action. And we have to take courage. We have to see what we really have to expect. We have to recognize and overcome deception and see how we can change society. So, taking courage. The Bible says in Romans, or Paul says in Romans 12, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, the good and pleasing, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Which means we have to look at the world critically and not just accept the patterns, the thinking patterns of others, but we have our own ones. Alvin Plantinga expressed that very nicely in his advice to Christian philosophers. It's from 84, so it's a while ago, but it's still very important. He says, so the Christian philosopher and other people who do science has his own topics and projects to think about. And when he thinks about the topics of current concern, he will think about them in his own way, which may be a different way. He may have to reject certain currently fashionable assumptions, and the Christian philosopher has the perfect right to the point of view and pre-philosophical assumptions he brings to the philosophic work. The fact that these are not widely shared outside the Christian community is interesting, but fundamentally irrelevant. So if we try to follow the assumptions of atheists when they argue, and we take them up and try to come to a Christian conclusion, that just won't work. We will always be in trouble. We have to reject assumptions which we do not believe. And of course, the question, truth is not democratic. Einstein was said to have said, it does not matter how much people have a different opinion. It's a question whether there is one among them who is right. So either things are true or not. And we should not be confused that many people think different than we do. This is just the way we have to expect. And there is a good news to this coming from the conformity experiments of Solomon Asch. I don't know if anybody knows him. It's in the 50s. He made a very simple experiment. He invited test subjects, students, and asked to assess the length of lines. So the exercise is very simple. The question is, which line on the right side has the same length as that one on the left side? It's not exactly the picture he had, but I made it up to show the principle. So basically, the answer is obvious. And what he did was he had several people sitting there and giving their judgment, but there was only one real test person, and the other three or four or five, they were instructed to give the wrong answers. So you have a setting where four or five people all give the wrong answer, and then there is this test, this real test person, he doesn't know of the setting, and he should give his answer. And the interesting thing is that if all people before give the wrong answer, then 37%, so more than one third, also of the real test persons also give the obviously wrong answer. So there is a sort of a group pressure which makes people to give an answer which they obviously have to see it's wrong. And then he changed the scenery, and that's the encouraging part, told one of the fake test persons, one of the instructed persons, to give the right answer. And if only one of the persons before gives the right answer, then the proportion of test persons who give an obviously wrong answer drops from 37 to 5%. So if in an audience or if in any discussion setting there is one person who dares to say, I do not really believe that I have another opinion, or is this really correct or so, then he can change the whole audience. He can make a vast difference. And that's something we should do. We should dare to put good questions. You will not convince the speaker, but you will convince maybe many of those people who are listening. So that's the task everybody can do. Ask good questions and challenge the opinion and try to free others to tell their opinion. That's something almost everyone can do. And then you can make a statement and go on depending on the scenery. So raising your voice as an individual can have an enormous impact. So that's a good news. What do we have to expect? Again, you belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding the truth, for there is no truth in him. And when he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So the more remote the scenery gets from God's truth, the more difficult it gets, and the less you can rely that the things that are happening are reasonable. So why expect the devil to be a gentleman? Why expect there to be no deceit? Why expect there to be no conspirations? Why expect logic? So these are things which you cannot expect. They may be there because many people who are not Christians look for truth. There are quite a lot of number who are not Christians who are looking desperately for truth. And they don't want to be woke. They don't want to step into any ideology. They're just looking for truth. And we should cooperate with them. So what we have to do is recognizing and overcoming deception. In Romans, it says, let everybody be subject, overcoming deception. And this deception comes to some extent, of course, from other people, and it comes to some extent from governments, because governments are not filled with lots of Christians, but they are filled with a mixture of people. And so many Christians would go for Romans 13, which is of course an important text, and it says, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which has been established by God, and the authorities exists, have been established by God. Consequently, who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of consciousness. So what do Christians make out of that? Usually Christians are pretty naive when it comes to governments and politics. And they say, oh, we do not get involved in politics. That's a dirty business. We don't want to be part of that. We keep out of it. The government works for the good, which is questionable. And if at all getting involved, then we pray for politicians, which is good, but not all. So the contradiction that I see is that many Christians behave as if they live in a monarchy rather than a democracy. But we live, I think all of us here, live in a democracy, so we have the chance to make an impact on society. And if we don't do, others will do. So we should not keep out, but we should see what is our task of influencing society for the good. The problem is agenda setting doesn't come from theologians, but mainly from left-wing or anti-Christian or utilitarian or just opportunistically minded people. And we have to see that very clear. They may be politicians, parliaments, governments, or whatever. And if this anti-Christian setting dominates, then humans are not anymore seen as subjects created in the image of God, but as objects of one's own interest. So we can command people to do this and this because we have been democratically elected, and so they have to obey, but they are not seen as subjects, and this is a big difference. And the consequences are that the protection and preference of special interest groups is taking very much room. No matter how minute they are, if they have a representation in parliament, they have benefits which other people don't have. And that has, of course, nothing to do with justice. And there is a disrespect and discrimination of other groups. And we see this very strongly with Christians, that churches or pastors or so are discriminated because they have opinions that do not fit into the general mainstream. And all that is done under the pretense of human flourishing. The justification is always good. It's always for the good of all, but sometimes it's only for the good of few. And we should recognize that. And this development is going on. And as Christians, and as theologians especially, we have always to look behind the scene. There is an invisible world, and this invisible world is in connection with the visible world and influences what's happening. And in Revelation 13, there is a very interesting passage, which I think you may know, where it says, people worship the dragon, as a picture of the devil, because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worship the beast and ask, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? And it opened his mouth and blasphemed God to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live on earth, or live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them, and was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose name have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Interestingly, this speaks of a worldwide government, and if we have one day, perhaps a worldwide government, then this worldwide government will have worldwide power. And the more power a government has, the more dangerous it will get. That's what we learned before. So what we are looking at is a fundamental rebellion against God, and it's And that's interesting. I realized that only after reading this passage a couple of times, a voluntary worship and submission of under ungodly rulers of a population that doesn't know God. And that makes the scenery very difficult because people are, as it seems, not forced to worship these ungodly powers, but they want to because they see the great deeds of these ungodly rulers. So, how can we change society? Can we change society? How did Neo-Marxism succeed? Neo-Marxism had a long breath, 50, 60 years. It's a marathon, not a sprint. They penetrated the institutions. Rudi Dutschke, one of the student leaders, said, we have to go through the long march through the institutions. They worked with subversion. Judith Butler talked about feminism and the subversion of identity. And finally, if you have the power to do so, you can use a top-down approach. The United Nations First World Conference on Women in 1995 in Beijing is an example where gender mainstreaming was installed. No one knew what it is. There was no definition, but then it was spread over the whole world without anybody voting for it. The summary of J.D. Hunter to change the world is very instructive in this respect. He says, ideas have consequences in history. Not because they are inherently truthful or obviously correct, but rather because of the way they are embedded in very powerful institutions, networks, interests, and symbols. And he says the most profound change in culture typically takes place over the course of multiple generations. That's what we have seen in Germany. That's what we have seen in other countries. They can be seen first as they penetrate into the linguistic and mythic fabric of a social order, so people start to talk differently. That's what we very strongly see in German language. In doing so, it then penetrates the hierarchy of rewards and privileges and deprivations and punishments that organize social life. So if you are not willing to use this language, if you are not willing to talk in this and this way, if you are not willing to accept these and these standards, then you have a problem. And cultural change of these steps can only be seen and described in retrospective. Now we see what has happened in the last 50 years, especially also in the last 20 years. So how can we act? How to change society? Prayer is, of course, very important. There are many organizations, there are some very good organizations praying for politics, praying for society. We have to have a long breath. It's not a thing that happens in 1 or 2 years. And I think we have to stop wasting our time on reinterpreting fundamental biblical concepts. Just forget about demythologization. Just forget about Bultmann and all this stuff. Just is not helpful. It's poisoning your mind and it's not helpful for anybody. And we have to be at the top of the scientific debates, which are for theologians normally interdisciplinary. So theologians have to have a certain grasp of natural science, of philosophy, to see which arguments are really relevant and which arguments are just pushed forwards and in reality don't have any relevance. And that's sometimes difficult to distinguish. We have to have a prophetic view. What is going on? Not what is now just going on, but what is the consequence of what is going on now? And where will we be in 5 or 10 years? And how can we react today to change what we will see or what we maybe see in 5 or 10 years? And we need creativity. I miss a little bit of creativity when it comes to social concepts. We think pretty much in these boxes that have been formed by others. And we need a strategic presence at all socially relevant institutions. Christians need to be in political parties, in every party. It's no use of a Christian party. Christians should disperse them among as many as possible parties to influence all political parties. Should be at universities, education, in the educational systems. So we have to be in all society contexts to influence society. And be convincing and not subversive. The thesis of my book, God and the Explanation of the World, is that Christian faith gives a better explanation of the existence of the world and how the world and the properties of the world. So normally Christians think, oh, the atheists, the naturalists, they have all the better explanations and they know so much and we can't compete. I think that the opposite is true. We have the better resources and we have the better explanations, and we should put that forward. And make friends with non-Christians which are looking for truth. I'm in some secular organizations like a network of Science of Freedom, where there are Christians and non-Christians, and there are so many people, so many intelligent people, so many people looking for truth. They believe there is truth, and they look for truth, and we should associate with them because they will be open also to the gospel. Maybe not immediately, but in the long run, they will see there is something different. Yeah, we should not isolate to smaller and smaller groups. And of course, trust in God to do great things. One major example for me is the German reunification in 1919. In 1990, I was a PhD student, and I was on a scientific excursion to Berlin. And on that day, the wall opened. And the message came, oh, the wall is open. And I said, do we have 1st of April? What is going on? Yeah. So it was so unbelievable to people until it really happened. And then the East German government, the former East German government, they said, we thought of everything, but not of candles and prayers. So something that could not have been made up, that was just very unique. So I'd also say go through every open door, and if there is no open door, then look at the window. So don't be shy and try to really be at the spot God wants you, and be open for God's surprises, because that's the power that is on our side. So, what can theologians do? They need a clear view on false ideology, such as justice. There are many others. They need to encourage the church. They should tear out the roots of pseudo-scientific views on the Bible. Just get rid of it. Highlight the relevance of truth for any meaningful interaction. If we give up truth, we have no basis to come to any conclusion. We cannot even come to the conclusion that we disagree because we have no arguments anymore. Have a clear understanding of deception. Develop a prophetic vision of church and society that goes far beyond that what's happening today. And I've heard that there are no Germans among the crowd here. So there are. I've written down most of these things in my book, The Free Society and Its Enemies, which resembles Popper's The Open Society and Its Enemies. But you can have some resources also in English language at the homepage, which I've given here. There are some talks which go in a similar direction. So, and you also find the paper on miracles and natural laws and some other stuff for your information.